out, everybody.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your host, Austin.
And I'm the producer, Daniel.
And today we are covering probably one of the most disturbing cases we've covered in a while. I think it's been a minute since we've covered a case truly as disturbing and unsettling as this one is.
Yeah, I think the weird part about this one is the, I guess, co-conspirators, like how she got so many people involved in this, like children,
including neighborhood kids.
Yeah, that's the weirdest part to me. I mean, I could understand one psychopath, you know, in a room, but yeah, you just start convincing a whole neighborhood of kids. It's wild.
Yeah, to partake in the brutal abuse, really torture, of 16-year-old Sylvia Likens. This case is the single worst crime perpetrated against an individual in Indiana's history, and that holds up. I think this is it's a rough one. There's really not much else to say other than this is a truly, truly brutal case. And Gertrude Banaszewski, really feel like is just
the stuff of
pure
nightmare.
Evil, man. Yeah. There is no redeeming qualities about her whatsoever. I don't care about her past. I don't feel bad for her at all. This is just somebody who perpetrated evil onto a young girl who absolutely really should have never been in that situation in the first place. There's a lot of blame, I think, that could be put on her parents.
Absolutely.
At the end of the day.
Absolutely. I also think, like, we will be going into the history of the perpetrator here, the main perpetrator, but yeah, I think that's more of an explanation for what's happening and no excuses for it.
No.
But you can kind of piece together why the sick motivations were there.
Yeah, yeah. This one left me just feeling, I had to go just like clear my head after this. It is just so rough and disturbing what happens to poor Sylvia. And maybe you've not heard of this case before, but maybe you've seen the movie An American Crime. There's also The Girl Next Door, which is more of like a horror movie that's kind of inspired by this case. Both of them, they don't get it exactly right, but it kind of gives you a visual idea, a little bit of what Sylvia went through. Obviously, it's nothing compared to the real thing, but if you've seen those movies are based off of this case. But I'm going to take a deep breath before I get into this one. This one is really rough, but let's go ahead and get into things here. Starting back at the very beginning of Sylvia Marie Likens' life. She was born on January 3rd, 1949 in Lebanon, Indiana. She was a middle child with two older siblings, Daniel and Diana. And she also had two younger siblings who are named Benny and Jenny. And basically, there are two sets of fraternal twins. Her younger sister, Jenny, suffered from polio when she was a child, and this made one of her legs much weaker than the other. So she needed a leg brace to assist her with walking. Sylvia was also described as having a big personality and quick-witted. She was confident and pretty. Although she was missing a front tooth from a tussle with her older brother when she was young, she often felt lonely among her siblings since the twins usually spent time with each other, and she felt like everyone was born with a friend. But she didn't, right? She's kind of feeling left out in her own family despite having all the brothers and sisters. But at the end of the day, she knew that her family and her siblings loved her. She'd also often defend her sister Jenny, who'd get made fun of because of her leg braces, which I always have to like kind of try to put myself in that space of such a long time ago, and polio was like just really trying to wrap my head around what that was like for people, and it's just a different world.
Yeah. Thank God for vaccines now. We don't really have to deal with that much anymore. But yeah, a pretty brutal disease.
But Sylvia's parents were Lester and Betty, and they worked for a carnival. And so they traveled around Indiana selling candy and soda and working for the carnival. Lester only had an 8th grade education and money was always tight. He had once tried to run a restaurant but failed. So when money ran low, the couple traveled for work, so the children went and stayed, usually with their grandparents during this time. Diana was the only one to live on her own since she got married at 18 and moved out. Lester and Betty considered having Sylvia and Jenny work for them in the carnival during the summers, but they worried about their safety because, as you can imagine, there's probably some sketchballs, potentially ex-cons working for the carnival or current cons working for the carnival.
Right.
So maybe not the safest place for children to hang out. But in July of 1965, their parents split up. Their mother, Betty, took 15-year-old Sylvia and 14-year-old Jenny and left the rest of the family. They headed on over to Indianapolis, where they lived in an apartment. Betty, soon after moving there, was arrested for shoplifting while out with her two daughters. Sylvia and Jenny walked back home and waited for their mother, but she never returned. A few days went by and the two girls were left to live at the apartment by themselves. And while out one day, they soon crossed paths with a friend from school, Darlene McGuire. Darlene was heading to a local hangout with some other kids, and so Jenny and Sylvia decided to tag along. They headed on over to a house at 3850 East New York Street, which wasn't too far from their apartment. And that's where they were introduced to a 16-year-old girl named Paula, who was living there. And Paula's mother was Gertrude Banaszewski. Sylvia didn't know it then, but Gertrude, her family, and even some of the neighbors would soon make her life a living hell.
So we're going to dive back into Gertrude Banaszewski's history here. She was born Gertrude Nadine Van Fossen, and she was later Gertrude Banaszewski. She was born on September 22nd, 1929, in Indianapolis, Indiana. Her parents were Hugh and Molly Van Fossen, and she was the third of six children in a working-class family. Her mother showed affection to her other five siblings, but she generally disliked Gertrude, and she was actually her father Hugh's favorite, which made her siblings and her mother dislike her a bit. She was kind of a target for bullying in her family. And once when she was 11, she was reading a book with 50-year-old Hugh when he suddenly collapsed. He actually died from a heart attack on the spot. Her mother, Molly, ran into the room and immediately accused Gertrude of causing his death, and this added even more drama and resentment towards Gertrude within her own family. Her mother would always blame her for her father's death. Sometimes Gertrude would wake up from nightmares, and her mother would punish her for waking up the other children. Her sisters also hated her and spread a rumor that she was promiscuous and had gotten several sexually transmitted infections. With this trouble at home, and obviously that would bleed into her social life as well, this also bled into her school life. Her siblings tortured her by telling other students to bully and gang up on her. Her own mother even spread rumors about Gertrude, saying that she was a whore who slept with strange men. And over the years, Gertrude formed a hatred toward other women for the way she was treated. She eventually dropped out of school at the age of 16 and married 18-year-old Deputy John Banaszewski. Gertrude was generally unfamiliar with domestic duties that John expected of her. Her mother hadn't really taught her how to cook or clean, which was kind of expected from a mid-1900s housewife. But she did find some work at a drugstore where she worked as a clerk to bring in some extra money for the family. And when Gertrude was 19, she gave birth to their first child, a daughter named Paula. Paula will be pretty critical in the rest of this tale here. 2 years after that, she gave birth to another daughter named Stephanie, and reportedly she struggled to care for her children. It's been suggested that her own upbringing may have affected the way she treated her own daughters.
Which I think is obviously true,
right?
I think
her sisters, maybe she's projecting that.
Yeah. Which again, it's not an excuse to continue that cycle of abuse, right? Like you can make a change there.
Yeah. If anything, it's your responsibility to break that cycle.
Right. Make it better.
Right.
Learn something from your experience.
But after Stephanie was born, Gertrude had a nervous breakdown. She was then diagnosed with neuroticism. This isn't really something that doctors diagnose anyone with today. But a neurotic disorder, this could mean something along the lines of like general anxiety disorder or obsessive compulsive disorder. Others suggest she may have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder or borderline personality disorder if she were examined within today's standards, but that is not up to us to decide.
Kind of a blanket term they used.
Yeah. So we don't actually really know by today's standards what exactly what was wrong with her. But despite her issues, she, you know, kind of tried her best to be present for her children. She later gave birth to two more who were named John and Marie. And this is John Jr., actually. John, the father, who was an alcoholic, he was terrible with money. He reportedly had a bad temper and would often beat Gertrude. But despite their problems, they stayed together for 10 years before finally divorcing in 1955, and she was given full custody of her children.
Less than a year later, she met and married a man named Edward Guthrie, and they divorced 3 months later because he was annoyed with her children and reportedly hit one of them. Some suspect that he only married Gertrude for her child support payments. Soon after, she remarried her first husband, John. She became pregnant again, but miscarried when the baby was almost full term. After this, she fell into a deep depression, which John had little sympathy for. His violent temper returned, and he began physically assaulting her once again. Later, they tried for another child, and once she was pregnant, Gertrude's depression seemed to fade away, and John stopped assaulting her. But she unfortunately miscarried again, and she fell into another depression. She eventually had two more children, Shirley and James, but she had 5 miscarriages along the way, many of them late term. After 7 years together, after reconciling their marriage, John filed for divorce in 1963, and they never got back together again. Near the end of their marriage, money was very tight, and Gertrude was worried about losing her home. So she began having an affair with a 27-year-old married man named Dennis Lee Wright, who was also an abusive man with a short temper. Gertrude and her children later moved in with him after his wife moved out. Gertrude would manipulate him with sex, and she became pregnant twice with him. One ended in a miscarriage, possibly due to Dennis's abuse, because he never wanted children. He allegedly punched her in the face and stomach until she miscarried. So very traumatic things are happening to Gertrude, for sure. She later gave birth to their only child, Dennis Jr. And surprisingly, Dennis was fine with her having the child, even though he always expressed that he never wanted children. And this would be her last child. So in total, Gertrude had 7 children. And when she returned from the hospital after giving birth, Dennis had abandoned her. He was only fine with her having the child because he had decided he would leave her after that child was born. In response, Gertrude stopped eating and lost a significant amount of weight in just a few weeks. She was also a chain smoker, which negatively affected her health. She also began going by the name Gertrude Wright and told her son Dennis Lee Wright Jr. when he got older that his father had gone away to join the army. She tried to file a paternity suit against Dennis Sr. for financial support, but he ignored it, saying that the child wasn't his. Meanwhile, John Banaszewski failed to pay his child support payments, so Gertrude began doing chores for her neighbors for extra cash, like ironing and laundry. This also included babysitting many of the neighborhood children, but at times she struggled with her mental health and couldn't keep up the household. And reportedly, she was on prescription medication at the time, but it's unclear exactly which kind of prescription medication. She then fell into poor health once again, dropped to around 100 pounds, and began to resent her 7 children. With barely any money, she saw them as a drain on her finances. And because of her failing health, her daughter Paula would run the house at times and take care of her siblings. You ever feel like your money is just vanishing out of your account every week?
Always.
Money just seems to escape faster than it comes in. There seems like a new streaming service pops up every month. I'm like, what is this?
We're back to cable.
Yes. Yeah, it's like, what was the point of that? The whole point is to consolidate. Now we're just have 18 different streaming accounts and it's double expensive. What
right,
cable
yeah.
So it can be tricky these days to manage your finances, but Rocket Money has really helped Austin and I get our finances in check and just give us that peace of mind. Rocket Money's got all the tools you need. It's a free app, free website, and it gives you a bunch of different features. It also allows you to see your recurring withdrawals. It allows you to see deposits. It also notifies you when your utility bills are coming out of your account, which is really nice. Rocket Money has got tons of features that you can use for free, but if you get their premium version, which is what we have, you also get some additional features like credit monitoring, which is super important these days with all the scammers out there. You want to make sure somebody's monitoring your credit for you. So if you don't have anything right now, Rocket Money is a great place to start. They also have the ability to cancel subscriptions for you with a few taps. They also have the ability to negotiate lower bills for you, which they'll tell you which ones they could potentially go negotiate a lower rate for. Just lots of great features, man. So many great things to save money with Rocket Money.
Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Rocket Money has saved users over $2.5 billion, including over $880 million in canceled subscriptions alone. Their 10 million members save up to $740 a year when they use all the app's premium features. So go and cancel your unwanted subscriptions and reach your financial goals faster with Rocket Money. Go to rocketmoney.com/lightsout today. That's rocketmoney.com/lightsout. rocketmoney.com/lightsout. Their house at 3850 East New York Street became a popular place for the neighborhood kids to hang out, mostly because they could get away with drinking and smoking without much parental supervision. I mean, this is a pretty large house too from the photos. We're looking at two stories, possibly even like a third story up there. I don't know if I had to guess what that's like a 5-bedroom home or something. I mean, there's a lot of space in here.
It's not a shack.
Yeah. There's a lot of space for people to hang out inside this house. Gertrude's spirit was elevated because she loved the attention of all the teenage children in her house, which is weird. And she once reportedly gave some of the neighborhood boys a striptease at the home. So this, to come back to Sylvia, this was the same home that Sylvia and Jenny ended up at in 1965. You remember, her mother never came home to the apartment. They saw their friend. Their friend kind of led them over to this house. So on that day that Sylvia and Jenny Likens met Paula and Gertrude Banaszewski, Paula asked her mother if they could stay for dinner. Gertrude said that Jenny was welcome, but Sylvia was not. She already hated the fact that Sylvia was pretty, confident, and this young girl with a big personality. Jenny protested, saying that she couldn't be separated from her older sister, so Gertrude allowed them both to stay the night. At around midnight that night, their father Lester and their brother Daniel showed up to the house, and Lester had gotten a new carnival job and had gone to the apartment to ask Betty if she wanted to join, but she still was not there. His daughters then told him about the shoplifting incident and how she hadn't been home since her arrest days earlier. Reportedly, she was released soon after being arrested, but she never went back to find her daughters at the apartment. She instead went to stay with her parents.
Which, who does that?
That's crazy.
Just basically abandoned them.
Right?
Because she just don't want to go deal with that.
Right.
She's just, I don't understand. Yeah, I don't get the Likens at all.
No.
The parents.
No, it seems like people who irresponsibly had children and then think of them as an afterthought.
Just like, they'll be fine. They'll figure it out.
Yeah. And I know Josh kind of led with this earlier in the episode where you can place a bit of blame on the parents. I mean, we're seeing it right here. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
They wouldn't have even gone to the house probably if their mother was home. Right.
Right.
And they wouldn't really need a place to stay if their mother was at home.
Their parents just were parents and provided basic things for them.
Right. Lester then told both Sylvia and Jenny that they'd be staying with their grandmother in Lebanon while he went out to work at the carnival. It's unclear who first brought up the idea of Gertrude watching the children. I guess this is a debate because, you know, if you want to cast blame on exactly who, because this really starts the whole thing here, but really it doesn't matter. Either way, Gertrude agreed to watch Lester's daughter for $20 a week. Both Sylvia and Jenny told Lester they'd rather stay with Gertrude instead of their grandmother, allegedly. So Lester agreed, and he gave Gertrude $20 for that first week, and then he left with his son. He later found Betty at her parents' house, and she joined Lester and their son Daniel in working at the carnival, while the other siblings stayed with their grandparents, and Sylvia and Jenny were left in the house with Gertrude and her 7 children. The only sibling that was out on their own was Diana. I believe she was even married at this point. So the other siblings went to stay with grandparents. Jenny and Sylvia went to stay with Gertrude, and I believe Daniel went to work with his parents. So basically, yeah, Sylvia and Jenny are left in this house with Gertrude and her 7 children. And the situation soon turned into this living nightmare. What's weird is there was no stove. There weren't even enough beds to sleep everybody. The house was filthy, and the children had to even share silverware while they ate. They didn't have enough silverware. And to be a good sport about it, to help out at first, Sylvia did some house chores to help clean up, take some of the load off. A couple weeks passed, and Lester's $20 payment for another week never arrived. Gertrude then slapped and beat the sisters and said, "I took care of you two bitches for a week for nothing." Sylvia told Gertrude to focus her beating on her instead of her little sister Jenny, saying that she was older and she could take it. The money ended up arriving the next day, but Gertrude did not apologize for the abuse. And the next week, Betty and Lester returned to the house on East New York Street to check on them, and neither Sylvia or Jenny mentioned the beating. Allegedly, Lester had even told Gertrude before he originally left that physical punishment could be used on the girls, and in one account, Lester even told Gertrude to straighten his daughters out when he left them with her. Before leaving again, Lester handed Gertrude another $20 for another week for watching his daughter, and they would be stuck with her basically indefinitely, however long this job at the carnival lasted.
Which, obviously, by Lester saying things like this,
yeah,
he's kind of signaling to Gertrude, like, hey, I'm okay with whatever form of punishment you want to give out.
Yeah.
Not knowing probably like the extent at which things are going to get to, but at the same time, it's such a weird thing to do. You know, it just shows the lack of care that he has for his kids. So he'd be like, yeah, she needs to be straightened out. Go ahead and straighten her out.
Right.
You can use physical punishment.
Yeah. And like Sylvia and Jenny hearing that from their own dad, that's probably why they didn't bring it up when their parents came back. Because like our dad gave the go ahead for this. So why would we even say anything?
Yeah. Ugh. Well, one day later, Sylvia and Jenny headed to the park to collect empty bottles out of trash cans to exchange them for some bottle return cash. They bought some candy with the money and returned to the house to share their haul with some of the other children. Gertrude immediately assumed that the girls had stolen this candy, so she forced them into a bedroom and beat them with a wooden paddle. She'd often hit them on the backside like a spanking, but then she would move up to their back and even the back of their head as time went on. So it started out as just spanking with a wooden paddle, which was fairly common back then, but to then move that up their back and eventually to their head is insane. Gertrude was a frail woman with weak muscles, so she required paddles, belts, or various household items in order to, as she would put it, discipline, but really abuse the sisters. The beatings were so intense sometimes that Gertrude's asthma and bronchitis would flare up, so she would get her daughter Paula to fill in and have her beat the sisters for her. Some of the other children would fabricate stories to get Sylvia in trouble, just so that she'd be beaten. And over time, Gertrude had successfully turned her children against the girls, just like her siblings had turned against her when she was young. Gertrude even forced Jenny to join in on the beatings of her own sister, and she would threaten Jenny, saying that if she didn't beat her sister, she'd have to take her sister's place as the household's main punching bag. Jenny reluctantly hit her sister when ordered. Paula had typically been friendly with the sisters early on, but when she was ordered by her mother to beat Sylvia and Jenny, she complied without question. Soon it was very clear that Paula was not their friend, and she was possibly as sadistic as her mother. In August of 1965, Paula was seen with a broken wrist, and during a backyard barbecue, neighbors witnessed her bragging about punching Sylvia so hard in the face that she broke her arm. She even told one witness that she had tried to kill her. And Sylvia was also seen with a black eye.
Good God.
It's just like, why are we doing anything here? The next door neighbors, Phyllis and Raymond Vermillion, did not report this to the authorities. Reportedly, Gertrude had even admitted to beating Sylvia to the Vermillions after they had seen Sylvia rummaging through their trash for food. But still, they did not go to the police, which shame on these neighbors. My God. Phyllis also witnessed Sylvia walking around in a daze when she visited the house to borrow something. She saw her with swollen lips and a black eye. Paula then showed Phyllis how Sylvia had gotten the wounds. Dramatically, she took a belt and began whipping Sylvia with it, claiming that she was a whore and pregnant with a man's child, which was not true. Still, Phyllis did not report this to the police. Reportedly, a different neighbor made a complaint to the school about Sylvia's wounds. A school nurse later visited the home, but Sylvia wasn't there. And Gertrude explained that Sylvia was always out of the house prostituting herself, which is why she had gotten her wounds, and then she kicked that school nurse out of the house. The school didn't look into the abuse anymore after that. And I think what my takeaway is, like, Gertrude scared everybody. Everybody was scared of Gertrude. Mm. The neighbors are scared of her. Even the school nurse, to some extent, is probably scared of her.
I mean, even just looking at her, she looks like a scary woman.
Yeah, which I get. Like, she just seems vile and
intimidating.
Think people picked up on that.
Yeah.
Like, would she do that to me? I don't know. But it's just wild that she's going around saying the 16-year-old girl is just getting these wounds out, prostituting herself, and nobody's like, that doesn't sound right.
What's the point of CPS then if, like, that's totally worth it enough if you're, I don't know, it's not her legal guardian, but it's like, what is this child doing out there prostituting herself, like, even if that was true?
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. And then also, it's like, I get that punishment was different. I know a lot of people were physically punished back in this time period, but I think anybody even then would have been like black eye, swollen lips. Like, you would have thought something else was going on here. They're taking this too far.
Yeah.
And nobody says anything.
Also, I don't know about you guys. I've never really heard I've never seen like someone wounded like that and then another sibling being like, yeah, I was trying to kill her. I've never experienced that.
I know, like, that's normal.
Some, like, maybe some sibling rivalry or something, but they weren't even sisters. It's just
the red flags going up are insane. Yeah. And just everybody's kind of turning a blind eye to it. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, later back at the house, Paula heard that Sylvia had called Gertrude a bitch. So she used the plaster cast on her wrist, because remember, she had broken her arm, and she used that cast to beat Sylvia across the face, which if you've ever had a cast or worn a cast or touched one,
they're all really
fucking
hard.
Like a rock. Yeah.
And they're like rough against the surface.
Oh my God. Just absolutely brutal. She also beat Sylvia with the cast again after Gertrude accused her of stealing $10. And the abuse from there only got worse. Gertrude began starving the girls. She made sure that both Sylvia and Jenny were the last to eat, and with so many mouths to feed, there was only so much food to go around. So the other children got priority to eat first, and if there's anything left, then Sylvia and Jenny could eat. And sometimes Gertrude would even punish Sylvia for scrounging for the last bits of food.
Yeah, it's like, no wonder she's out in the trash cans looking for scraps, because she's starving.
Yeah. Oh, it's diabolical, man. It's just, there's just no excuse for any of this at all.
No. And one time while at a church function, the sisters ate a full meal, but when they all returned to the house, Paula told Sylvia and Jenny that they had eaten too much. So she stripped them both down and paddled them. She struck Sylvia 15 times on the back. So even when they do get a full meal, they're punished for it. So it's like, either way, they're just going to be punished for anything. During another incident, Sylvia and Jenny's older sister Diana came to visit, and the sisters left the house for a while, and Diana bought Sylvia a sandwich to eat because she could see that her sister was hungry. 2 months later, when Gertrude found out about this sandwich, Sylvia was brutally beaten with a paddle again. So this torture and abuse continued for weeks, pretty much nonstop, and one day a neighborhood boy by the name of Randy Lepper visited the house. Gertrude, Polly, and Randy agreed that it would be funny if they loaded up a hot dog with as much condiments and spices as they could and then forced Sylvia to eat it. Sylvia refused, but Gertrude forced the hot dog into her mouth and smeared the condiments and spices across her face. So now Sylvia was not only starved as a form of torture, but now force-fed disgusting foods as a form of torture as well. Gertrude physically forced the food into Sylvia's mouth and down her throat with her fingers. Sylvia ended up vomiting. Gertrude then grabbed Sylvia by the hair, pulled her down to the floor, and forced her to eat her own vomit off of the floor. She told her it was rude to waste food. And meanwhile, Paula and Randy laughed as they watched Sylvia eat her own vomit. This is the weird part. It's like, how many people are complicit in all this?
Yeah, watching this abuse happen.
I cannot imagine.
Don't any of these people have a conscience?
Right? What is in the water supply?
What the hell?
Right?
That you're laughing at that?
Yeah.
This poor girl.
I would be so disturbed. I can also only imagine, knowing that they're using this house to like smoke and drink and do whatever, I wonder if they're all kind of
like fucked
inebriated
up.
Yeah. During all this as well.
Could be. I mean, it's hard to think that they're all stone cold sober,
right?
While this is happening. I mean, could be though.
That was, yeah, I don't know. But by the end of that summer, Sylvia was pretty much the main subject of abuse in the household. Jenny was still occasionally beaten, but not nearly as abused as Sylvia, and Gertrude had gotten all of her children, and even some of the neighborhood children, to target Sylvia. Meanwhile, Paula, Stephanie, and Sylvia attended Arsenal Technical High School, and Stephanie was one of the only people in the household that treated Sylvia with even the most remoteness of kindness. They also both worked together in the school cafeteria, and it was through this job that Sylvia was able to get a free lunch from the school, thankfully. This became one of the two opportunities where Sylvia can eat in peace. Depending on the severity of the abuse at the house, sometimes Sylvia's meals at school were the only one she would get for an entire day. Out of frustration at the abuse she was subjected to, she began a rumor around school saying that the Banaszewski girls, especially Stephanie, would have sex with any boy for money. When the rumor was traced back to her, the abuse back at the house got even worse than before. And a boy once came up to Stephanie and asked her how much she would charge to have sex with him. So Stephanie found Sylvia at school and punched her in the face. She later apologized and they both remained friends. Stephanie remained one of Sylvia's only allies in the household. Unfortunately, though, Stephanie's 15-year-old boyfriend, Coy Hubbard, also heard about these rumors. He soon confronted Sylvia and assaulted her as well, and this was encouraged by Gertrude, since word of the rumors against Stephanie eventually also made its way back to Gertrude as well, and she let Coy beat Sylvia, which included slamming her into walls, kicking her, and throwing her down to the floor. Gertrude also beat Sylvia with a belt and later held lit matches against her fingers, and after seeing Coy beat Sylvia, Gertrude then thought, hey, she could just start using the neighborhood boys if she needed more muscle, because as we mentioned earlier, she was pretty frail and weak. From then on, the neighborhood boys were always welcome inside the house.
Now that Halloween's over, it's time for the holidays, time for Christmas, time for all the fun times with family, and maybe you're hosting your family at your place this year, and you know, you don't want to be embarrassed when they come over and they look around and there's crap everywhere.
Yeah, it's so, why are you living in squalor?
There's scum in the toilet.
Yeah.
There's a ring in the toilet and everybody
in the bathtub.
Yeah.
Like was the Cat in the Hat here?
Yeah.
What is this?
You don't want to have an adverse reaction from your family. You want them to come back. You don't want them to come in and then leave immediately. But maybe you're busy. Maybe you're out there working hard, you know, making that money so that you can buy Christmas presents, and you don't have time to clean that up. Well, HomeAglow is a great option for getting your home cleaned. HomeAglow is a top-rated home service platform dedicated to making your space clean and tidy. What's great about them is they have online booking capabilities that really fit around your schedule, which is nice, versus other services you kind of have to work off of when they can fit you in. But with HomeAglow, you can find a cleaner that's able to work with your schedule, you know, to make sure that, you know, it's not interfering with anything you got going on personally. And then, yeah, you get a beautiful clean. They'll clean all that up for you, make your house look brand new, smell good, everything shiny. HomeAglow's got expert cleaners to help you in every way, shape, or form. And what's great is it's a great way to support cleaners in your community, because 100% of cleaning fees and tips go directly to your cleaner, which we love to see that.
You know what? Really cool part about this? The best part, arguably, is their Forever Clean membership. It actually saves you about $30 an hour on all future cleanings. And you can book unlimited cleanings starting at $19 an hour, backed by HomeAglow's Happiness Guarantee.
I love a happiness guarantee.
Same. Take home cleaning off your plate this holiday season by using HomoGlow. Head to homoglow.com/lightsout to get your first 3 hours of cleaning for only $19. That's HomeAglow.com/lightsout.
I don't think I've run across a case quite like this one ever.
It's really weird.
Where somebody like this is then recruiting the neighborhood kids to come and take part in this abuse and encouraging it. And the fact that all these kids are like, okay, yeah, sure, I'll do it too.
Yeah.
It's just wild. It's like, I just don't understand. Due to the abuse, Sylvia couldn't attend school any longer. Early into the school year, she had lost a significant amount of weight. And she had, of course, bruises, burns, and scratches all over her body. Despite losing weight, Gertrude would tell Sylvia she was getting fat and that she was pregnant, which, of course, none of that was true. She also constantly called Sylvia a whore with several sexually transmitted infections and that she was sleeping around with all the neighborhood boys, even though Sylvia hadn't actually had a single sexual experience yet. Friends of Sylvia soon came to the house looking for her, but Gertrude would spread lies and rumors about Sylvia to get all of her friends to hate her and forget about her. Many of the rumors involved Sylvia sleeping with various boys, especially boyfriends of her friends, and getting pregnant. One of Sylvia's best friends was 13-year-old Anna Sisko. Gertrude convinced her that Sylvia was telling everyone at school that her mother was a whore and was prostituting herself for $5. Anna later slapped and kicked Sylvia inside the house. Other children tried to separate them, but Gertrude encouraged them to keep fighting. By now, Gertrude and her children weren't the only ones consistently abusing Sylvia. Several other neighborhood children were also involved. Gertrude circulated enough rumors to get several children to attack Sylvia on site inside the home. Gertrude and Paula would also frequently join in on the violence. Meanwhile, Gertrude's health continued to decline. She chain smoked, and she chain smoked unlike anything we could probably even imagine. I mean, it was cigarette after cigarette after cigarette. She had lost a ton of weight. And I mean, you look at a picture of her, she's in her 30s and she looks about 89.
Right. She's 36, which is about, you know, 3-4 years older than I am. Yet she looks like she could be my mom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gertrude lost a ton of weight. She started looking skeletal. And really, she's just chronically ill at this point. And she has horrible hygiene. You can only imagine what this woman smelled like. Her breath smelled like, her teeth.
No.
Just horrific. She soon began scapegoating Sylvia for her poor health, which also meant that Sylvia was adding to her medical bills, which affected the financial situation of the whole entire home. Gertrude found any chance she could to make others hate Sylvia. And sometime in mid-September, Paula offered Sylvia the smallest bit of kindness, but only once. Paula dragged Sylvia to the back door of the house. She opened the door and told Sylvia to leave for her own safety. Seeing as she had no place to go, Sylvia declined and said she'd rather stay at the house, which says a lot. Because I think maybe in your mind, you're thinking, why doesn't she just leave? The next time she goes to school, just don't come home. But you have to remember, she literally has nowhere to go.
Yeah, her parents are gone. There's no phone at the house either. She probably has no money.
No money? Like, what is she going to do? Sleep on the street?
Yeah, that would literally be the alternative.
So, because it's easy to judge somebody, right? Be like, she's being abused like this. Why doesn't she just run away and not come back? And it's like, well, where is she going to run away to? Is that, you know, in her mind, is that going to be a better situation for her? And she's probably worried about her sister, Jenny.
Right, yeah.
She also is trying to protect her sister, trying to make sure she keeps an eye on her because she doesn't want... If she leaves, I think she thinks Jenny's going to become the new victim.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so she's trying to protect her sister by staying, which is, it's just, the whole thing is a horrible, horrible situation to be in. In early October, there was a small bit of hope when Lester and Betty came to visit their daughters. Oh, looky here.
Finally
came home from the fucking carnival.
Yep.
Neither Sylvia nor Jenny told their parents about the horrors going on in the home, except for the fact that they were often hungry. So Lester and Betty took them out for some sodas and gave them some cash to buy some new shoes. They also paid for another week for the girls to stay with Gertrude. Sylvia did her best to cover up her wounds because she didn't want to worry her parents, and Jenny and Sylvia also thought that if they did tell their parents about what was truly going on at Gertrude's house, that as soon as they left, Gertrude would punish them even more, which they're probably 100% right about
that. Yeah, they're just living in fear.
After a short visit, their parents left to go work at a carnival in Florida, which I was like, God, times must have been really rough if they're just like, oh, leave our kids here and go to the carnival. But they promised that they would be back in 3 weeks. And on their return, they would be back for a much longer time period so they could finally take the girls home. But sadly, this would be far too late for poor Sylvia. The violence against her escalated even more so. Her wounds wouldn't heal because she was so malnourished. And a neighbor even spotted her going through the trash can looking for food. Gertrude caught her when she came back inside, and a few neighborhood boys and Jenny were also with her. She threatened Sylvia and told her to strip naked. She then demanded that she take a glass Coke bottle and put it into her vagina in front of the other boys and her own sister. Sylvia was still a virgin at this time, but Gertrude called her a whore in front of all of them, and then she forced that bottle inside of her, causing her to scream and all the boys to cheer in excitement, which is just the most horrific thing I can possibly think of. Just horribly brutal. Shocked by the noise, Stephanie then entered the room and slapped Sylvia. When Gertrude pulled the bottle out of her, Sylvia was brutally wounded by this bottle, obviously, and clearly bleeding. She then fled to the bedroom, which was now the cold basement because she slept beneath the stairs. Gertrude would often lock the basement door to keep her down there, which is a scary, looks to be a very unfinished basement.
Yeah, it's like a cellar.
A dungeon.
Almost.
She's just in a dungeon.
Cinder block and like a cement floor.
And now the violence is really escalating. She's being tortured, essentially.
Yeah.
And in front of everybody. It's just unbelievable.
So after these, you know, just countless rounds of torture, humiliation, and physical beatings, Gertrude would force Sylvia to take baths in scalding hot water so she could be, quote unquote, cleansed of her sins. She would also make her children give Sylvia the torturous baths. She wouldn't even do it herself. She just got her children to. And Sylvia had begun wetting the mattress in the basement, which led to even more of these torturous baths. Eventually, she had to take a scalding hot bath about every other night. And various children would also rub salt into her open wounds. It was around this time that Gertrude decided that Sylvia wasn't fit to live among the other children. She continued to abuse her, like putting lit matches against her skin or tossing lit matches at her, and once her clothes even caught fire, but it was put out pretty quickly. In mid-October, Gertrude coerced Sylvia into writing a letter to her parents. In this letter, she falsely confessed that she was causing trouble for Gertrude all the time. Gertrude then held on to this letter so she could use it when she needed it. This letter will come around a bit later. Gertrude later got her 12-year-old son, John Jr., to take his younger sibling's soiled diapers and rub them on Sylvia and force her to lick them. She was also pressured to drink urine, but it's unclear if she ever did. Near the end of October, Sylvia was given a bowl of soup, but told she could only eat it with her hands. Another day, Gertrude tied her to the basement stairs and only fed her a few crackers. Her malnutrition worsened, and that same night she was tied to her mattress and threatened not to wet herself. Her physical abuse and poor health had damaged her kidneys to the point where she could barely control her urination. So it wasn't even up to her if she would wet herself or not. And obviously, you know, this led to more of those scalding hot baths. Gertrude also forbade her from using the bathroom and would often tie her up in the basement above the mattress. So it's like, you can't use the bathroom. We're putting you here in the basement. I'm tying you here, but do not wet the bed. It's just a sick game to continue this torture.
It literally is.
The mattress was placed under the stairs, and Gertrude would tie her hands up to the stairs so she couldn't even lay down. She would hang there, and she would leave her there for hours without food or water. And because of her incontinence issues, Sylvia ended up wetting the bed often. So Gertrude, as always, decided that the physical punishment and scalding hot baths were the answer. Here's an even weirder part. She even began charging the neighborhood kids 5 cents to abuse Sylvia. And 14-year-old neighbor Richard Dean Hobbs, who went by Ricky, would come over to the house pretty often. He was self-admittedly a friend of Gertrude's. I don't know how a 14-year-old kind of becomes friends with a 36-year-old.
That's well, when the 36-year-old's hitting on the teenager,
yep,
it's going to create that weird dynamic, that inappropriate relationship that's going on.
Yeah. And he had also been one of the boys she had performed a striptease for as well. So God. Apparently his own mother suffered from terminal cancer and his father was often busy with work. So he would just go over to Gertrude's house and hang out. And Gertrude once commanded him to brand Sylvia as punishment. Along with the help of Gertrude and her 11-year-old daughter, Marie, Ricky carved the words, "I'm a prostitute and proud of it," into Sylvia's stomach with a heated pin. Gertrude was the one that started it, but she only got to the M, the second letter, and then she made Ricky finish the rest because she said she was feeling sick. According to him, he made the etchings short and light so they wouldn't hurt as much. All right. Sylvia barely responded to the pain, which must have been excruciating, but she was just so weak and malnourished that she basically just laid there. Then they hauled her back into the basement where Gertrude heated up the end of a crowbar and she wanted to brand an S into Sylvia's chest above the pin marks. Ricky helped her and instead they messed up the branding and instead of getting an S, it came out as the number three. Gertrude then told Sylvia that no one would ever marry her now that she was branded and she asked, "What are you going to do now?" Sylvia responded, "I guess there's nothing I can do."
It's incredible to me that Sylvia has just been holding on.
Yeah, honestly.
Through all of this. It's just like, it's unimaginable to me to even like be able to think what this would have been like.
Yeah. Also, I like Ricky. It disgusts me that he was like, "Look, I made the etchings short and light." Like that's some sort of mercy to her. It's so gross.
All of the children in this entire neighborhood are disgusting.
Yeah.
They all deserve prison sentences for decades and decades. Yeah.
Privately, Sylvia told Jenny she thought she was going to die soon. She could barely walk and her wounds weren't healing. Jenny told her to try to hang on and that things were going to be okay. But apparently Sylvia had overheard Gertrude telling one of her children that she was going to kill Sylvia. A few days later, Sylvia tried to escape on October 24th. In her weakened state, she failed, and Gertrude easily caught her on the porch and forced her into the kitchen. She then forced her to eat so Sylvia could continue to endure the torture. Her mouth was so swollen, she struggled to swallow any of the food. Gertrude then took a metal curtain rod and beat her in the face until the rod bent. Coy Hubbard also joined in and beat her until she fell unconscious. The next day, her sister Jenny saw how dire Sylvia's condition was. She also tried to get her to eat, but couldn't. Later that night, Sylvia used all of her energy to scream for help when she was tied up in the basement, but it was no use. On October 26, Gertrude was convinced that Sylvia was on the brink of death. She could barely move, speak, or eat, and she couldn't even get past four letters of the alphabet when asked to do so. So Gertrude threw her back in the basement. Sylvia later defecated on herself, so Gertrude got the other children to cover Sylvia in laundry detergent to try to clean her up. Then John Jr. hosed her down the yard with a garden hose while laughing. Gertrude also stomped on Sylvia's head several times. Stephanie came home and turned off the hose and she tried to get Sylvia up the stairs for a decent bath because she was the only one of the children that still considered her a friend. She wanted to give Sylvia a bit of mercy, but she was too weak to get up the stairs to get to the bathtub. Sometime later, Ricky Hobbs came over and found Stephanie crying near Sylvia. He noticed that Sylvia was on the floor, barely breathing. He then got Sylvia upstairs to take a bath. Ricky, Stephanie, and a few others then wrapped her in a clean towel and led her to the mattress on the floor of one of the bedrooms. They later laid her down, and Sylvia then looked at Stephanie and asked if she would take her home. In her final words, she wished that her daddy was with her, which just absolutely breaks my heart. She stopped breathing soon after. Ricky and Stephanie attempted mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, but it was too late. 16-year-old Sylvia Likens suffered physical beatings, starvation, sexual assault, and humiliation for nearly 3 months straight until she finally succumbed to her wounds. Gertrude later barged in and said it was all an act and that Sylvia was faking death. She screamed, "Faker! Faker!" over and over. And then she beat Sylvia's head with a book, which angered Stephanie, and she shouted at her mother to leave them alone. Pretty soon, Gertrude realized that Sylvia was truly dead. Hours passed by before she told Ricky that it was time to call emergency services.
Josh, have you ever bled from your forehead because you were so stressed?
Bled?
Do you know that's possible?
You can bleed?
You can rupture like your blood vessels in your head. And so it's like you're sweating blood, like Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane.
Oh, shit.
You can become so stressed that blood is just seeping from your
Thank
forehead.
Thank you for the new fear unlocked.
Yeah.
No, I have not bled from my forehead due to stress, thank God. I have been stressed, though, and it's difficult.
Yeah.
You know? It's not good for your health, either.
Stress is a physical health affliction, you know? It's a big deal. So head to ZocDoc if you guys really need to get some weird niche stuff checked out, or if you just need to find, you know, a PCP, get a regular checkup. I highly recommend it. And ZocDoc makes it so convenient to just find the exact doctor that you're looking for through covered under your insurance, which is the best part. Their search function is awesome. You can also go and see the ratings on there. So, you know, if they say Dr. So-and-so is kind of weird, kind of creepy, his hands are too cold, etc. You can get it all checked out. Leave it to a professional to take care of you. You know, you want to be in good hands with your health. And you know, American healthcare, say what you will about it, but you got to go get your stuff checked out. I know too many men
who
just put it off. I don't need it. They'll take their dog to the vet right on schedule, but they'll put off, I got a heart murmur and chest pain. As it's nothing. It's nothing. So you men out there, go get your stuff checked out, because you never know, something could be wrong.
It's a free app and website where you can go and search and then compare high quality in-network doctors or physicians or providers and click to instantly book an appointment. And again, it's not just doctors, it's therapists, it's psychiatrists, it's dentists, really anything pertaining to the human body. Go search it in ZocDoc and they'll
be a specialist.
There'll be somebody, a podiatrist, you know. But what's great is you can book appointments within 24 to 72 hours. Occasionally, you can also score same-day appointments. I know I've gotten lucky and gotten same-day appointments for urgent care. That's the other thing, too. You can get appointments for urgent care through ZocDoc, which is really great to have in your back pocket, especially when you're stressed, you're going through a situation, you're really sick. You don't have time or the energy to go, like, call and, like, see and, you know, call different places. Just go on ZocDoc. Type in urgent care, your insurance, and they'll find you an appointment in your area really fast. It's really nice service. We love it. You'll love it. So stop putting off those doctor's appointments and go to ZocDoc.com/lightsout to find and instantly book a top-rated doctor today.
That's ZocDoc.com/lightsout. ZocDoc.com/lightsout. There was no phone inside the house, so Ricky ran to the closest payphone and called 911. Gertrude used those few hours after Sylvia's death to gather up her children and Jenny so they could rehearse what they would tell the police. When the Indianapolis police finally came to the home on the corner of East New York Street and North Denny Street, Gertrude stuck to a made-up story she had concocted, and Officer Melvin Dixon was the first to the house. And Gertrude led him to the body of Sylvia Likens. 150 cuts, punctures, scrapes, burns, and bruises covered her body, and she was severely emaciated from lack of food and water. Her fingernails were bent backward, and her skin was so dry it was peeling off of her hands. Her vagina had also swollen shut from the constant abuse, and in her final moments, she had also bitten through her own lip. Many of the wounds were in various stages of recovery, which showed that her trauma had been going on for weeks before her death. The coroner's report would also show that her liver was yellow and showed obvious signs of malnutrition. Her kidneys and brain were also severely damaged. Her genitals were also red and swollen, which would later be connected to the glass soda bottle incident. She officially died of subdural hematoma, which is a collection of blood near the outer layer of the brain due to head trauma. It's actually believed that the final blows from Coy Hubbard may have caused her death. If you remember, he had
the curtain rod,
the iron curtain rod. And if any of you are confused about Coy Hubbard, that was Stephanie's boyfriend at the time. Reportedly, by the time police had found her, Sylvia had been dead for some 8 to 12 hours. So it wasn't like this thing like, oh, she had died, and then they realized, and then she was like, okay, Ricky, go call the police. This was, they were kind of hanging around the house. Gertrude probably sat the children down, gave everyone the rundown, what they would tell police, et cetera, but Gertrude had concocted this story and told police that Sylvia had run away, had sex with strange boys in the woods, and they later beat her to death and then dumped her body at the house. She mentioned that Sylvia was always a troublemaker and she often engaged in these depraved sex parties. Gertrude tried to act sad and even cried in front of the police. She told them that she had found Sylvia outside the house on the porch, still alive but badly beaten, and she tried to revive her, but she died soon after. Paula was also seen walking around the house with a Bible in her hands, trying to look very pious in front of the police. And she also leaned over and whispered to Jenny that Sylvia was meant to die, that God did not make mistakes. She then offered for Jenny to live with them as their own sister. But Jenny was obviously terrified, and she actually did initially stick to the story that Gertrude had fed them all. And Gertrude then showed the police that letter that she had coerced Sylvia into writing, and she claimed that Sylvia had given her the letter in her final moments, and it was addressed to her parents. In the letter, Sylvia described what had happened to her, which lined up exactly with what Gertrude had described. She also confessed that she was always trouble for Gertrude. The others in the house corroborated that story.
Yeah, take a look at what this letter said. It reads, "To Mr. and Mrs. Likens, I went with a gang of boys in the middle of the night, and they said that they would pay me if I would give them something. So I got in the car and they all got what they wanted. And when they got finished, they beat me up and left sores on my face and all over my body. And they also put on my stomach, 'I am a prostitute and proud of it.' I have done just about everything that I could do just to make Gertie mad and cause Gertie to spend more money than she's got. I've tore up a new mattress and peed on it. I also have cost Gertie doctor bills that she really can't pay and made Gertie a nervous wreck and all her kids. I cost her $35 for a hospital in one day, and I couldn't do nothing around the house. I've done anything to do things to make things out of the way to make things worse for them."
She couldn't even like write, it seems like.
Yeah.
She's probably in such poor health that she doesn't even know what she's writing.
And oddly, the police officer believed the story, despite it being odd that Sylvia would call her parents Mr. and Mrs. Likens.
That doesn't make sense.
Like, duh.
What?
It would also make no sense for her to be fatally attacked and then have the time and energy to then write a letter.
Yeah. She's dying.
Why
on the
would
porch
she do that?
And then, it's so stupid.
The coroner was then called, and they prepared for the body to be transported. Just before law enforcement left, Jenny finally saw her chance. As soon as she was out of earshot from Gertrude, she whispered to one of the police officers, saying that if she got her out of there, she would tell them the truth. Once they got Jenny to safety, that's exactly what she did. She told them everything. And after telling the police everything that she could remember, they took her to stay with her sister Diana while they tried to get in touch with her parents. Gertrude was then arrested, thank God, finally, including her children, Paula, Stephanie, and John Jr. Police also went out and got some of the neighborhood boys, including Ricky Hobbs and Coy Hubbard. In the interrogation room, Gertrude denied everything, of course. She told officers that she had absolutely nothing to do with Sylvia's abuse or her death. She blamed everything on her own daughter, Paula. Gertrude's story didn't match up with any of the children's statements, especially Ricky Hobbs' statement, which we found a clip of Ricky talking to the news back in 1965. Let's take a listen to that.
"All I did was write that thing on her stomach, and I hit her about 10 or 15 times.
But that's all I did.
Yeah.
Well, most because Gertie told me to."
Hoover then spoke to one of the Banachewski children, who told him how the victim was treated.
"She refused food. We tried to get her soup every once in a while, and stuff like that, and she wouldn't take it."
"Well, how about these scratch marks on her stomach? Who put them on her?"
"I did."
"Why?"
"Well, Gertie just thought of it. She said since you branded us, we're going to brand you. So she itched in her with a pen, and I went over it. She showed me how to do it, and then I went over it. I did it."
"Did you ever use any hot irons on her?"
"No." "Yeah, that three on her stomach, I did half of that. Mm-hmm. Shirley Ann did the other half."
"Where'd the S come from?"
"What do you mean?"
"There's a big S branded on her stomach, right below one of her breasts."
"That's what I'm talking about."
"Well, that's what you're talking about. But how about the inscription on there. I'm a prostitute and proud of it. Who put that on?
I did.
Did you scratch it on there, paint it on there? How'd you do it?
Well, like I said before, Gertie wrote it down there with a pen, and I did the rest. Mm-hmm. She showed me how to do it. And
had Gertie abused this girl?
Yeah.
And then here's another clip of him describing how Sylvia died.
Well, she, I come in and about come up from the basement, and we noticed she's cold and everything, so we carried her upstairs, give her a warm bath and artificial respiration. When she stopped breathing, see, we gave her a warm bath, and then she stopped breathing. And so I gave her artificial respiration for about 10 minutes, and then I went and called the police.
Now let's hear Gertrude's denial. I'm sure you're curious to know what she had to say.
I did never beat that girl. Never. She was beat up on by other girls. In fact, my own daughter saw her in the jaw and broke her wrist. And so, I mean, there you go. And girl around the neighborhood beat her up, bloodied her nose. One girl broke her nose, in fact, I think.
Were you ever in contact with the police on any of these occasions?
Well, in the last 2 weeks, in fact, I think if you talk to my daughters, I'd ask them that. The children's father and I are divorced, and he's a policeman in Leechcove or was. And I've asked the girls repeatedly, called their dad, and asked them what to do. And in fact, I asked Jenny, I said, Jenny, and I told Sylvia, I said, Sylvia, I'm going to have to call the police or somebody because I can't have any responsibility.
Yes. What a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah. I think that's so damning, too. Like, oh, why didn't you contact the police if this amount of violence was going on to the point where she died? And then it's like, oh, well, I had an ex-husband who was a police. And so I told my children to reach out to him. What are you talking about? That's ridiculous.
No, she's at that point still thinking that she can try to blame this on everybody else and remove the responsibility from herself.
Yeah, which she did there because she even said, oh, my daughter punched her in the jaw.
Yeah, literally,
broke her wrist,
just throwing everybody else in the blood. Yeah. Crazy.
So in response to Gertrude's story, Paula admitted to some of the abuse, and so did John Jr. And Paula even was seen smirking and laughing in the presence of her psychiatrist when they talked about the instances of abuse against Sylvia. Both children implicated their mother as the mastermind of the operations. John Jr. also mentioned four other neighborhood kids involved in the abuse, and police later arrested Mike Monroe, Randy Lepper, Darlene McGuire, Judy Duke, and Anna Sisko for assault. They were all minors, and they would end up blaming Gertrude for pressuring them to abuse and torture Sylvia. These neighborhood children were later released after being questioned. They were not charged. But those who were charged, Gertrude Banaszewski, 37, her daughter Paula, 17, her other daughter Stephanie, 15, her son John Jr., who's only 12, and then the neighborhood children, Coy Hubbard, who was 15, and Ricky Hobbs, who was 15. They were all charged initially with first-degree murder of Sylvia Likens, and the trial began on April 18th, 1966, and they were all tried together. Gertrude defended herself, saying that she didn't know what had happened and that she hadn't been in her right mind during the events in question. She pointed to her history of mental health issues and several late-term miscarriages as proof that she hadn't been in her right mind. She also claimed that her children and the neighborhood kids had free rein in her home and she couldn't control all of them. She called it a madhouse, and she claimed that Paula was in charge of the household. All of the children and Sylvia's sister Jenny took the stand during the trial. Gertrude did not. The children's testimonies confirmed that Gertrude had ordered them to subject Sylvia to beatings and abuse. They also confirmed that Gertrude regularly beat Sylvia using several different objects as weapons. Stephanie also testified and told the court about how Paula had beaten Sylvia on several occasions, especially the severe abuse with her plaster cast. This was also corroborated by another neighborhood girl and fellow churchgoer named Grace Sargent. Grace sat next to Paula on the bus and listened to her brag about the abuse against Sylvia. She also mentioned to Grace how she tried to kill Sylvia. A neighborhood boy, Randy Lepper, testified saying that Gertrude ordered much of the abuse, and she also ordered Sylvia to undress in front of the boys. He actually laughed after mentioning this in court. He also admitted to hitting Sylvia somewhere between 10 to 40 occasions after being ordered by Gertrude and Paula. 13-year-old Judy Duke testified, saying that she witnessed salt being rubbed into Sylvia's wounds. She also witnessed 10-year-old Shirley Banaszewski rip open Sylvia's blouse, and Ricky Hobbs said, "Everybody's having fun with Sylvia." Roy Julian, a Baptist minister, took the stand and claimed he knew about the abuse but failed to report it to the authorities.
Lock him up.
What the hell?
He should have every title stripped from him. He should lose his job. Yeah. Like, that is just crazy.
And here's his excuse. It's nuts. Gertrude told him that Sylvia was prostituting herself, and Roy thought she was being punished for her sins. God. So that's why he was like, "Oh, this is fine then. She needs the punishment." Many others, including the neighbors, if you remember the Vermilions, said similar things like, "Oh, she just had to be punished and that was just normal." Gertrude told them lies about Sylvia and the physical abuse was just the punishment, and they were all just okay with it.
Yeah, what is this point of view on punishment?
It's like this whole community was fine.
When you see a young girl digging out of the trash for food,
come on.
That's punishment?
Right. Come on. The defense called the witness 11-year-old Mary Banaszewski, and reportedly she had been left in a room with Gertrude before testifying. It was also noted that a deputy sheriff noticed Marie would always look at her mother after being asked a question in court. The deputy sheriff saw Gertrude either nodding yes or no to relay answers to her daughter. Marie claimed that Gertrude only hurt Sylvia as a form of punishment if she was acting out. She also said that her mother never locked Sylvia in the basement. But after being questioned by the prosecution, Marie's story quickly fell apart. And when the prosecution questioned her, she changed her story entirely and admitted that her mother subjected Sylvia to most of the abuse in the household. In closing statements, the clearest indication of premeditated murder was that letter that Gertrude had forced Sylvia to write. She knew to hold on to that letter until Sylvia inevitably died. The defense, on the other hand, claimed that while Gertrude did commit the murder, she wasn't aware of her actions. They were really digging into this, like, oh, she was just out of her mind, and that's what happened. Gertrude had pled not guilty by reason of insanity. On May 16, 1966, a court-appointed doctor named Dwight Schuster testified and said that Gertrude was uncooperative in their interviews. Ultimately, he found Gertrude to be sane and fully in control of her actions during the abuse and murder of Sylvia Likens and in court, and he claimed that she was never psychotic.
Which I think his assessment there is huge.
Yeah.
For what happens next here, because on May 19th, 1966, after 8 hours of deliberation, Gertrude was found guilty of first-degree murder and she was sentenced to life in prison. Despite public pressure for the death penalty, which I would absolutely support in this case, the jury opted for life imprisonment. Paula was found guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison as well. John Jr., Coy Hubbard, and Ricky Hobbs were found guilty of manslaughter, and they were sentenced to 2 to 21 years in a state reformatory. They ended up serving 18 months and were released on parole in 1967, which
didn't even serve the full
2 years, the minimum portion of that sentence, which is crazy to me. Especially considering one of them likely gave the killing blow.
Right. How does that work out?
What? Like, I get they're minors, but like 18 months?
Yeah.
I'd be scared for the public safety that these two kids just walked in and started taking part in this abuse and torture.
Yeah.
Insane. With our next sponsor, you'll avoid the daily 5 p.m. of "What's for dinner,
Mom?"
Yeah, potentially Mom. Or, you know, you're asking your girlfriend, boyfriend, you know, "What's for dinner? What do you want to eat tonight?"
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you're somebody who loves eating, loves food, but hates cooking, hates cleaning. You know, you just want something easy, but you don't want to do takeout or delivery because that's all super expensive.
Yeah. Not Chili's again for the fifth time this week. You
can only get so many punches on your punch card before it's just embarrassing at that point. Yeah, Tavala is a cool meal service because they make it easier than any other meal service I've ever tried to have a delicious meal on the table. So they send you this high tech, like space age oven / broiler / searing. It does it all. It's a one stop shop for all things cooking. It can steam, it can broil, bake, you name it. And what's great is that you pick out your meals, they show up, they haven't been cooked yet. Most of the ingredients haven't been cooked. And then it's just they give you these little aluminum trays, and you literally just take the food out of the box. They tell you their little recipe card's super simple. It's like three steps. You put this in here. So for example, I did a macadamia encrusted salmon.
Whoa.
And I think it had risotto with it.
Yeah.
So the risotto was already in one of the tin pans. And then I just had to take the salmon, put it in another pan. I put the topping on it, put some seasoning on it. And then also it had broccoli. And then there's also another tray for that. And you just stick it all in to this oven. You take your recipe card and there's a little scanner on it. And you scan the recipe card. And then it just starts cooking everything like perfectly. You don't
Crazy.
Even have to think.
Crazy.
Yeah.
It's like the Jetsons.
Yeah, it really
is. I don't
know
if that's aging me a little bit, but that is like the Jetsons.
And what's great too is you don't have to just use their oven for their meals. You can actually get like Eggo waffles and scan the barcode on that and it'll cook those perfectly for you.
Crazy, man.
You don't have to only use it for their meals, but you can actually use it for other items or if you've got toaster strudels or microwave meals, you name it, it can scan it and it just knows how to cook it. It's really impressive, honestly. For a limited time, because you're a Lights Out listener, during Tavala's Black Friday sale, you can get a free Tavala smart oven when you order meals 6+ times by heading to tavala.com/lightsout and using our code lightsout.
That's a free Tavala smart oven when you head to tavala.com/lightsout and use promo code lightsout. One last time for the people in the back, that's TOVALA.com and make sure you use our promo code lightsout for a free Tavala smart oven. Remember, with Tavala, dinner is taken care of.
As for Stephanie, it was proven that she had not contributed to the injuries that murdered Sylvia, so her charges were dropped. Ricky Hobbs had suffered from nervous breakdowns and began chain smoking, and he died of lung cancer in 1972 at the age of 21. Which, damn, that's a serious chain smoking to get lung cancer that quick.
Or just smited by God.
Yeah, that's what I kind of feel like with this, is I'm like, is this just like karma? Coy Hubbard would be in and out of prison for various offenses, so he went on to be a piece of shit. And he would later marry and have 5 children before dying of a heart attack in 2007 at the age of 56.
So kind of lived a full life, a little bit.
Yeah, certainly, to some extent. John Jr. lived in obscurity under the alias John Blake, probably because it's so embarrassing to have a last name.
Mm-hmm.
Banaszewski, he became a truck driver, a lay minister, and a counselor of children with divorced parents. He married and had 3 children, and he died of diabetes in 2005 at the age of 52. Some reported that he felt like he should have been given a harsher sentence, which kind of agree. Other sources claimed he liked the attention he got from the case.
Oof.
Now, what about Sylvia's parents, Lester and Betty? Well, they separated in 1967. Betty died in 1999. The same year as her son, Benny, which was Jenny's twin brother, and Lester died in 2013. But in September 1970, the Indiana Supreme Court reversed Gertrude and Paula's convictions and ordered new trials for Gertrude and Paula. In their original trial, the judge ignored requests by the defense for a change of venue and separate trials. Paula pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter and was sentenced to 2 to 20 years in prison, even though she tried to escape prison twice. In 1971, she was released on parole the following year. Which, what the hell is this justice system, Indiana? What are we doing here? Released. In 2012, Paula was reportedly working as a teacher's aide for a high school counselor. She did this for 14 years. That's crazy. Prison, paroled, teacher's aide.
Went back to regular life.
Do they know what she went to prison for? What the hell?
That was the thing. She had like a fake identity.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Because she became Paula Pace. So they ditched the Banaszewski name because, of course, a quick little searcheroo in the newspaper archives, you know, they're going to find all that.
Yeah.
The school eventually received an anonymous tip about her past and true identity, so she was fired for providing false information on her application. It's believed she might still be alive today, living somewhere out there under a rock. As for Gertrude's new trial, she was found guilty of first-degree murder once again and sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 18 years before the opportunity for parole. While in prison, she changed her name as well to Nadine Van Fossen, which was her middle name and maiden last name. She was apparently well-behaved in prison, and some even called her mom. This is fucking weird, man. Her parole hearing later caused a lot of public uproar, as it should, my God. Jenny Likens organized a massive protest, and thousands of people signed a petition to keep her ass in prison where she belongs. We did track down some old news footage here of Jenny, Gertrude, and a member of the parole board at the hearing in 1985.
If Returner Gertrude Banaszewski lose, she might as well put me in prison, because I would be in prison in my own home, for afraid to go anywhere by myself again.
Banaszewski told the parole board she's a born-again Christian. She burst into tears when asked to talk about her crime.
I can't do it. And I'm sorry. That's all I can say. And I ask him to forgive me. That's all I can tell you.
Once again, the board voted 3-2 to let Banaszewski go.
The bottom line, you cannot bring someone who is dead and gone back to life. And I wouldn't be a member of this board if I didn't believe people could change.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. And like the parole board lady where she's like, you know, I wouldn't be on this board if I didn't believe in, you know, a second chance. I agree with that. But this woman, I don't, what are you talking about? And that we already know she can use crocodile tears, right? Because that's what she did with the police officer. So how do we know she's being earnest in that?
Danny, what's your thoughts?
I can understand people changing after like a crime of passion, you know, a heated argument escalates, something like that. But this was 3 months of calculated, meticulous torture and manipulation of children around the neighborhood. She is a vile, disgusting woman who deserves no sympathy and deserves never to see the light of day again. And honestly, that entire neighborhood should burn down. It's disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting. I am irate about this whole situation.
And I feel like the religious call out is just always like
born again.
In a lot of cases, not always, but in a lot of cases, I feel like it's, they know that that's going to work with the parole board or the member, whatever it is. It makes them look good. And it's an easy thing to say. It was like, what about when all this went down and you were caught, the fact that you took no responsibility, you denied all accusations. You know, it's not like you were remorseful from the beginning, right?
Exactly.
Like, there's different ways to handle this. And it's like, no, you just hate prison and you just want to get out and you have an opportunity to get out. So you're going to say whatever you need to say in order to try to win over the parole board.
She tried to blame her 17-year-old daughter during the first investigation. Yeah. Like,
I mean, at the end of the day, my perspective is like, especially when we're dealing with minors and we're dealing with children, there is zero place for people in society who ever do this to children, where they should be let back into society again. That's just my own personal opinion. I think they should all rot in prison. In some cases, I think they should just be taken out completely. But I disagree that she should have ever been let out on parole, because that's what happened. They let her out on parole. They're like, she's changed. She's forgiven. Come on, man. Yeah. This woman is diabolical. If there's anybody that's got the devil in her, it's this one. So despite everybody coming out and poor Jenny, right? I think what she said is very, just rings true. I will never feel safe in my home. Like, what about Jenny? She lost her sister. She went through this abuse as well. And the fact that you're going to parole her, you're going to make Jenny's life hell once again, because she's now going to know that the person that did this to her sister and to her is now sleeping easy at night, free once again. There's just so many problems with that, in my opinion. But Gertrude got out December 1985, and when asked about her crimes by the parole board, she said she couldn't remember due to the medication she was taking, which again, we don't know what that medication was, but again, making excuses, blame the medication. So that means you couldn't remember anything else. If you can't remember what you did, then you would have remembered anything else. And that's just not the case. Again, blaming others. She's not taking responsibility. But Gertrude, she went on to live in obscurity in Iowa. And thank God. But she later died 61 years old of lung cancer on June 16, 1990. And hopefully Jenny got some peace when she found out that she finally was no longer alive. Jenny Likens lived with the case prosecutor's family for a while after the murder of her sister. She later married and had two children of her own while living in Beech Grove, Indiana, and she later died in 2004 at the age of 54. After Sylvia's death, the home, that house of horrors at 3850 East New York Street, became a target for vandals. The home was covered in graffiti before they eventually demolished it, as they should. Like Danny said, maybe they should just continue down the block there. The property is now a parking lot. And as I had mentioned at the beginning, there was a film in 2007, American Crime, which was based on the Likens murder, that debuted at the Sundance Film Festival. That same year, Stars Home Entertainment released The Girl Next Door, which was adapted from the 1989 horror novel of the same name, which is loosely based on the murder of Sylvia Likens. But in June 2001, which took him long enough, a memorial to Sylvia Likens was put up. A 6-foot granite block was unveiled in Willard Park. Which, if you want to go see it, it's at 1700 East Washington Street in Indianapolis. Several hundred people attended the ceremony, including Fred Lawrence, a high school classmate of Sylvia's. On October 26, 1965, he had been walking past the Banaszewski house as Sylvia's body was carried out by the authorities. But man, this is one of the worst cases I've covered since doing the show. It's just absolutely horrific. Everything that happened, I'm glad that some justice was served here, but not nearly enough in my eyes. Like, I think they should have went way harder at everybody that took part in this. I mean, the guy that likely dealt that final blow served 18 months. And like, kid, it was a minor, but again, harsher punishment should have been instilled in this for sure. There's just no excuse for any of this. This is somebody, and I think, did mental illness play a part in this? I think absolutely. Sure. I think clearly Gertrude, from her past, she dealt with some similar trauma there, but she kept that cycle of abuse going, and then she just ramped it up because it gave her a sense of control and power, and she obviously was very jealous of Sylvia. She's this pretty, you know, has everything going for her. People like her. People just didn't fucking like Gertrude. And so she used that against her and did the unthinkable. I think, I hope there's a, if hell exists, I hope there's a, I hope that's where she ended up, because that's where she deserves to be. It's just diabolical. But really not much else to say about this one. Horrible in every way, shape, or form. Let us know your thoughts, of course. And if you've seen either of those movies as well, let us know what you thought of them. But we're going to go ahead and end today's episode with a little... We have a couple clips that are a few interviews from a 2015 memorial for Sylvia. Her sister Diana is present, actually, and she speaks. I think it's only right in these types of cases where it's just... horrible. It's best to remember the victim at the end of the day and what they went through, and make sure they're never forgotten. So that's it for us today. We'll see you guys next week. Till then, lights out, everybody.
This is in your honor. We love you so. We miss you. And I will see you again someday. Thank you all for loving her. And you, by being here, you love her.
It's an honor.
Thank you so much.
Gertrude made her a prisoner. Gertrude encouraged others to physically abuse her, to emotionally abuse her, and she abused her.
The love and the heartache is still there, you know. The knowledge of what she went through is still there. I love you, sis.